doesn't matter if you're ready.
This episode of the Backpack Show brought to you by Joe Polizzi Content Incorporated. This is what they gave us for a sponsorship banner. So isn't that the best thing ever?
I love it. I wish it just had a third box, like for another person.
Returning for the third or maybe more times, our dear friend, Dr. Robert Brooks. We're going to talk about his new book, one out of 806 that he's written, called Tenacity in Children. Look at that. We both have
My kids don't need this. Boy, do they never give up.
They're tenacious. And then we have Heather, our younger, who is the founder of Employee Fanatics. And we have so much to talk with her about.
A listening culture, for one thing, why you need one and how you can cultivate one at your organization.
Oh my gosh, do I need this like right now too? Because it's you know, you can't presume that there's a listening culture. Mrs. Claus or Mix-a-Lot? What do you think? Mrs. Claus or Mix-a-Lot?
Mrs. Claus. I always like Mrs. Claus.
Welcome to the Backpack Show with your hosts, Chris Brogan and Carrie Gargone. Boom shakalaka.
Just like, what business show are you ever going to see Santa on? Just ours.
Oh, look at Robert Collins' little graphic. He switched it to Eric Carle. Rest in peace, Eric Carle.
That's really sweet. Aw. I'm sad about that.
Yeah.
The very hungry caterpillar out there. No one likes a skinny Santa.
Brown bear, what do you see? I mean, that's sometimes we have to live through now.
Yeah.
So yesterday we had a couple of authors on. Today we have authors on. What the heck? Can we get some people that do something else? Like, you know,
these people do other things.
Drum and bass. I don't know. Yeah.
Sure, and they don't just
write. We had Joe yesterday. The cookie delivery man. But today we're going to talk to Heather Younger, and we're going to ask about employee fanatics. We're going to ask about listening. We're going to ask about leadership. All the things we don't even know about. So it's a big day today. Big day. Let's grab her and start there.
Which means you got to change your banner.
Grab Dr. Brooks right after the, what I do?
My banner. I never wait for you to do it because you have a listening problem. Actually, we need Heather out here.
Hi, Heather. I'm not very good at listening, it turns out.
What if you tell somebody something thrice and they don't do it? What is that?
Oh, that's like clogged ears. I'm not sure what that is, but
clogged ears.
I was in a lot of bad metal bands growing up. Is that, can I blame that still?
Yeah, let's do that. Let's blame that.
Okay.
Like, even if it's selective, like come and go.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's self-centeredness, but okay. I won't really.
Oh, no. So how do we cultivate a listening organization? First of all, what's a listening culture?
Well, I mean, I think it's one that's it's bi-directional. It's two-way. It's supportive. You know, you think about it, like the organizations that are out there, the leaders that are out there, you may tell them something. You may do a survey. You may sit in a one-on-one or team meeting. And you may tell them something and you never hear anything back, right? Like, I can bet your bottom dollar people hate surveys. And they hate them because they never hear anything back that's been done based upon what they said about it. So the listening culture is one that's two-way, supportive, responsive, right? And people know what they've said was actually taken into account.
So then you can't just say, hey, we're listening to everything that you say. You have to actually prove it, like act on it.
Gosh. With listening, it's kind of like listening has multiple different behaviors. So it is this idea of like recognizing what's not being said, know that you don't know that there's something that's there that you're not aware of. And then this idea of actually listening, like just actively listening, leaning in, unplugging the ears, like we just talked about. Then there's this idea of acting upon what it is. So acting in strategic ways, like you don't have to act
like
every
acting thing. Interested. I've gotten really good at that.
Well, it's like we're talking about like kids. I have four kids. Like, I'm not going to act on everything. I may act by saying, no, that's an action. Or I may, you know, may spank them, whatever. I'm not, just kidding. Don't actually spank my kids. But, you know, that kind of thing where you're going to act some way on their behalf. And then this idea after that is of connecting the dots and or basically closing the loop. A lot of people don't do that. Organizations, again, this is back to the idea of there's a survey or there's a team meeting and you say, you give all this feedback. And then you may even see they did something like what? Oh, that changed. And that changed. But then they never tell you it was because of your feedback. They never connect your voice to the action they took. And that's where they just completely dropped the ball.
Bob says, Heather, be kind, but keep the jabs coming.
And Carl says, hey, I found you. Carl knew we were on a different time. He kind of forgot for a minute. So I reminded him the other day. I missed Carl. Heather, your book is The Art of Caring Leadership. And one question I have is listening at the core of that? I mean, is that one of the things that people need to understand is that if you're not listening, you're not going to get any of the rest of that stuff figured out?
Yeah, it pretty much is. I mean, even though I don't have that at the front of the book, it's in the book. It's one of the 9 behaviors that I was able to identify through my research. But so I have the first chapter being on self-leadership and saying that there's basically you cannot show up as a caring leader to other people until you've led yourself first. Listening is in there. And interestingly enough, that will be my next book is going to be wholly focused on listening, listening in this customer space, listening in the employee space, because it is so critical to everything else, right? If we aren't listening, we're not empathizing. If we aren't empathizing, we don't understand what's happening with anything around us. We can't take the proper action on behalf of anything that we're trying to get done. It just, nothing gets done until we listen. So you're right on with that.
Cool. You have your own show, your own podcast, Leadership with Heart, or something very close to that title.
Yes.
And in that podcast, you interview everybody from the people who run WD-40, to some Starbucks people and all that sort of thing. I feel like in some ways, this is one of those, when did you stop beating your wife kind of questions? Like there's no company that's going to be like, we don't care about our people. Like, how do you separate that? Like, how do you really kind of shake out of them what they're really doing to make that true? And have you ever had to call BS on a company that thinks they're leading with heart?
Not inside the interviews. Okay. Right. So in the, and I usually, I'll ask them one thing I do to kind of differentiate. So I ask them a set of questions. I get them comfortable. And then I do what they said earlier. I go in for the jab. And so I say to them, so when was there a time when you were not that best leader, the leader that you're proud of, the leader that was leading with heart? What did that look like specifically in a story? And then what did you do to come out of it? And so it's in that time period when I ask that question where they start telling the story and then based upon how they respond and how they came out of it makes me understand and other people listening like how to overcome it. So I'm not inviting perfect people on my show. They do come referred to me because people see them as a caring leader. They see them as someone who leads with heart. Are they perfect? Absolutely not. And none of this stuff I talk about is about perfection, right? It's about a continuous journey, trying to get better every single day, just a little bit more.
So Chip is getting in on the jab action here. You have a podcast called blah, 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 or something.
Yeah, it is. It's something like that.
It's like leading with heart or leadership with heart. That's I was close. I was in the neighborhood.
You were perfect. You said leadership with heart. That was absolutely right.
Thank
so
you.
There you go.
You're close
there
enough.
There you go, Chip.
Close enough.
So when we knock people into this concept of caring leadership, when you start saying, look, this is going to matter, if a company, depending on where they are in their stages, right? So if a company's publicly traded, they're like, look, that's wonderful. I really need to report my quarterlies to my shareholders. You know, what are you going to do for me there, younger?
And you're well, like, I tell them, you know, go ahead and do that. I bet your quarterlies aren't going to be as strong. Again, when I interviewed the CEO of WD-40 company, he talked about them changing their focus from, you know, all the profits. And he personally, as a CEO going, you know, I need to lead differently. And when he decided that it was the people that needed to come first, the market cap on that public traded company went way up. I mean, they were like in the hundreds of millions and went to like 2.2 billion. It was crazy. And there were other stories that are for private companies that did the same thing. They made the decision to show up with more heart in ways like policies and practices and behaviors in their leadership. And then all the way down the line, you know, to the front line of the organization, they decided to enforce certain behaviors. They decided to kick people out that didn't have the right behaviors. And that's what good culture is about.
So there are dollars and cents incentives or reasons that you should care about your employees and create a listening culture.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It's what people think it's squishy. I hate, they're like, oh, it's soft. I'm like, well, the soft stuff is actually the hardest stuff. And the soft stuff delivers the hardest results because people go over and above for you when they know you care for them. It's just the way it is.
Well, what about situations like we've had for the past year where everybody was remote, some of them for the first time, and now they're transitioning back to the office sometimes it's this weird hybrid situation. So how can you be sensitive to the changes people are going through and the adjustments that they need?
Yeah, I mean, I think if we, I'm telling you, it goes back to listening. If we spent the time during the pandemic when they were on their Zoom calls and their team meetings, paying attention to what was happening in the background with the kid, cat, and the dog and the child, the elderly parent, right? All the things. If we spent the time looking at that, paying attention, engaging with our people on that, when it's time to come back, well, number one, we probably will have already like worked through them through some of their issues. I mean, it's daycare, whatever it is. So when it's time to do the hybrid or come back, they're not as hard a position. Plus, they know you're in their corner because you were with them through the tough times. If you didn't do that, you're kind of messed up. I want to say another word, but I don't know if I can say that here. So yeah, it's you're in a bad place. But if you're trying to go back now and show all this heart and care, but you didn't do it throughout, I don't know what to say. But if you did a little bit of that, just even just a little bit, and you come back, the idea is to lean into that new knowledge. I call it data. That's all data. Everything I see behind you, I don't see much because I see guitar. So yes, I'm going to ask you. So you play guitar? Like, oh, that's where did you play? It's so awesome, right? And I want to look at that, you know, and think about it. When we get to the workplace, we don't see any of that stuff. And they just hide it all. And if they don't tell us, we don't know. So we need to say, oh my gosh, we have so much more data. That's what it is. What can we do to improve their experience? And they may still have to come back, by the way, but can they be involved in what the comeback looks like? Can we use their voices to make sure that experience is smoother for them? I think so.
We have a couple of questions from the community. Elizabeth asks, how do you get around if there's an informal mean girls boys club that affects an organization, assuming that not all leaders are in that club, but the club affects culture?
Well, I mean, if it's the organizational leaders who can actually do something about it, Elizabeth, then they should. I mean, we talked about culture really is this idea of behaviors that we allow and those that we basically don't. And so that means if we've already been really clear about what our culture is, what our values are to everyone, and they have been a part of what those value, like the value formation, then when we see those mean girls, we see that behavior, we call them on the carpet. And if they keep doing it, we get rid of them. I mean, so like caring leadership isn't all squishy soft. You have to do that in order to keep, you know, the entire team, everybody intact and not just the one or just the small group. Now, unfortunately, I know that doesn't happen a lot, right? I know that we let that behavior slide. It keeps going and going and it does bring it down. And obviously, if it's the leaders who are allowing it, you know, then you may have to just skadoodle.
Skadoodle. That's probably my favorite word I've heard today. Bob Collins says, Heather, when you take action based on feedback and actually listening, but don't recognize the people and their voice who provided the new direction, that's a missed opportunity.
It is. That's actually the power. They realize they have power in their voices when we tell them the action we took was tied to it. When we don't, that's where we miss the opportunity to show them that we really do truly care. So you're spot on with that.
There's also one right here from Chip that's an unusual not trolling remark. Chip loves to troll us.
What?
One of the things we teach new umpires is that behavior that you permit is behavior that you encourage.
It's so true. You can call me Touch Phil. You can call me what I'm the caring leader. So I wrote the book, The Embodiment. I am the embodiment. I'm not perfect, but that's just how I lead, right? So having said that, I remember there was an interaction that happened at work, and I was overseeing this like very eclectic crew. Two of the people on this crew didn't like their team lead that I put her in this team leadership role because she went over and above. She was always managing their schedules. She was doing all this stuff. But two of the ladies did not like her. So what happened is they were in the call center environment. So one day she's just doing like checks on, which is what one thing I wanted her to always do. She's checking to see how the, you know, customer service is. And she hears these two women talking about her behind her back on a recorded call. Ooh. So here's Heather, who I'm very about team and, you know, I'm listening, all the stuff I put, like I said in the book. But it's also, I'm also very clear about setting expectations and that team is important to me. So I call each of them individually in the office and I say, listen, this happened. I don't know why it happened because this person's always advocating for you. But in the end, I need you to know, I think you know that I value team above almost all things. And so you did this thing and you broke down team. It's not acceptable. I'm writing you up. And I wrote both of them up individually. I had never done that my entire life, managing people for like almost 30 years, or maybe not quite that much, 25 years. And in the end, it was like, you know, I didn't have any guilt over it because I knew it was the right thing to do because that person had already set the mark. She had created really strong behaviors in herself. She'd been over, you know, seeing and making sure the team was doing well. She was lifting people up, doing birthday party. I mean, it was just kind of crazy. I'm like, who are these people? How can you not support her when she supported you so much? So now I'm kind of pissed. Excuse me. I'm pissed. I'm like, So you didn't do that for her. You, and then you would go on a recorded call. So now, don't lie to me, because I can play it back if you like.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right. So this
so
is
what happened.
That behavior. I wasn't allowing that behavior.
It just wasn't. Did they change their attitude, or did they?
They leave? May not. You know, and the they obviously continued to work. One of them was like, she was already kind of curmudgeon anyway, so she, and then she retired at some point and is like, yeah, good, you know, because anybody who's going to do that on, do it period, but be stupid enough doing a recorded call where we're right. listening, you know.
Documentation.
So we won't miss you. Annette had a really long comment, so I'm going to put it here while we're all up here, so it doesn't cover your head. WD-40 Gary Ridge has been a real contributor to this region as a business leader. He's helped businesses navigate cultures from micromanagement to activating empowerment, and that creates tangible value.
Ooh, I love that, Annette. Yeah, he is one of my favorite leaders. He's called upon a lot, and I have him like on live shows, and I have him, I'm interviewing him, talking to him a lot, because there is so much there. And what, when he made the, I cannot remember the exact number, but I want to say that they were at, you know, 400 million or something. And when he decided to make a switch after being CEO for a long time, and he went and got like a degree in like leadership or something. And he was studying on under all these people, Kim Blanchard and all that. And he just, it just was like, I just hit him. And he decided I have to make sure that, and he calls his people his tribe. I have to make sure that like these people, that my tribe is like at the forefront. He goes down in the morning. He, you know, says hello to people by name, no matter what they're, you know, where they're at in the organization. He just does these things again, caring, leadership, and embodiment. It's not about the words. It's about the actions.
You have a little community built around, I mean, it could be a massive community. What do I know? You have a community built around caring leadership. You have caringleadership.co where people can come and take a look at that. What's that about?
Yeah. So when I created the book, I didn't want it to just be a book. This is my second book. I just want it to be a book and people read and they're like, oh, this is great. Yay. And they put it down. So what I did is at the back of the book, I have an invitation for people to take a self-assessment. It's free. They take the self-assessment and see how they are kind of on this. If they're truthful in their responses, they will then come up with an output. Then from there, we invite them to the Caring Leadership Community, where other leaders in development are there and they're kind of just working through issues and talking about things and asking questions. And there'll be events there and things. We just rolled the book out 2 months ago. So the community has maybe like 75 people in it. So it's not some massive thing right now, right? Then what happens is after they're there, they also have access to the Caring Leadership Community or Academy. And that is, right now there's 9 courses in it, and it's based upon the 9 behaviors the book. So it's like, if this was your shortcoming in your assessment, go take this course now. And then we also, what I've done is I recruited handpicked like 8 separate coaches, and they're caring leadership coaches. They're trained in the work that I do. And so that if somebody wants to have like the assessment and they want to have the academy and they want to have a coach help them through to get better. So it was this idea of creating an entire support system, or like an ecosystem of care is how I like to call it.
Coach Woodard's asking, how difficult is it for traditional leaders to make the shift to caring leaders? You unwittingly imply that traditionally leaders are not caring.
Yeah. Thank you, Scott, for that. You know, so there are really, when we think about any change, not even just in this space, but just any change, we have to first have an awareness that we are leaving gaps, like awareness that we have an issue, right? So that the leader has to first have the awareness that they're leaving gaps, harming those that look to them for guidance. After they realize, like they have this awareness, oh shoot, they have to have a desire to do something about it, right? And then after we've decided those two things, now it's like, but do they have the stamina to see it through? Think about any change of any employer or worker. The biggest complaint they see is, oh, we did this new system, or they add this new initiative, and then we never heard anything. Then they wrote out here's the 5th initiative, and then like the last year. It's because they didn't have the stamina or the wherewithal to see it through. So they have to have those 3 components. So that traditional leader has to have that self-awareness first.
It's when you say that, it's I don't know how many other people have been through that corporate experience of the boss reads, Jim Collins, Good to Great or something. So now we all have to figure out our hedgehog principle. And then they go read this other book. You got to go figure that out. Next, you know, they're on Freakonomics and you're like, stop reading.
Eating back to Who Moved My Cheese.
Yes.
Oh. That's like,
you get beat in the butt over and over again. So I'm glad you pointed that out. The other thing you commented on, this is just a comment, and I'm going to put you backstage so we can do some ad reads, is it's always been amazing to me. Your point was, so they finish your book, then what? You put a community together so people can gather and talk about the book, which is a smart, smart idea. Because one of the things that's always thrown me about people who read books is it's almost like they're playing reading bingo. Like, I've read this, now what should I read? Not like, this is software and I can implement it in my head and then I will be a better leader. Yeah. Like, they think there's like some kind of prize waiting at the pearly gates for the, you know, best book reading like you did in the summer when you were nine. It's important to kind of suck it in. Anyway, Heather Younger, thanks for being here. Stick around. We've got a little panel question for you. We're gonna put you backstage for a minute. Boop.
Like if your people are unhappy with your leadership, you can be like, I read all the books. I don't know.
I don't know what you're talking about.
what else you want. Oh, so apparently one of the reasons there's a serious shortage of sports officials has to do with this.
Coaches.
Yeah.
Coaches. I mean, shitty umps and coaches.
Well, they're agreeing. So this is an interesting side conversation.
Hey, that's what we do on the Shaq Pack
Blog. Yes.
Yes. All right. Let's do some ads because we have those.
Because we have to. Oh.
First,
guests of the show stay at the inconveniently located from downtown or anywhere, never to be confused with luxurious and never updated FDR Hotel, located somewhere off Highway 84 near an old gas station with a burned out van parked out front with a for sale sign.
They don't have a listening culture.
Did you say something?
I said that hotel does not have a listening culture.
Oh, they really don't.
My guess.
I have been a sports official for about a decade and have witnessed outrageous abuse.
And also visited it on others.
Hey, want to try a search engine that isn't Google? Presearch is pretty cool. Presearch.com, they have their own cryptocurrency tied to this thing. So if you hold some of their coins, you can become the search term for whatever you want to be. If you want to put in listening and it comes to Heather Younger, you just buy a couple of pre-coins and stake the term listening. And that's
you don't even pay. You're not paying the coins.
Just hold it.
Yeah. Just hold
the coin. You don't even have to give them away. So you have
the coin and the search term.
Right.
Also, I love having back.
Listen, do you love this video show, but you really hate our faces? You can listen to us anywhere. you know, absolutely faceless anywhere that you can get an audio podcast. Why? Because we're hosted by Castos. I mean, Castos faceless. Is a really kick butt hosting platform. Butts have been kicked. Say, would you like a .online domain? And who wouldn't? You can go to cbroga.me/online and get one. Use the code Chris, all caps. If you do that wrong, you get no discount. But if you use the code,
could get chipgriffin.online.
Chipgriffin.online or I'm the umpire.online or anything. Go get one of those. Hey, do you like this video show? Whack. StreamYard is how we make it. cbrogan.me/StreamYard. Boy, is this a great show. StreamYard. Hey, you hate the news?
Hey, you don't have to do them all at once. Hey. You can like sprinkle them here and there.
You know what I'm doing? I'm doing like a really bad half impression of Will Ferrell doing Harry Carey. I mean, hey.
Hey.
What's with the moon? If the moon were made out of cheese.
Green cheese.
Would you eat it? Here we go. Nonfiction. So if you hate the news, 50% of Americans are saying right now that they're really frustrated with all the bias coming from both the left and the right. Well, these guys that all came from incredible media backgrounds have decided to band together and make a company called Nonfiction Research. And their first big project is savingamericansfromthenews.com.
This go is when you like, look. Just want to know what's going on and you don't want to have a bunch of like commentary about it. You just want to know what happened today.
We love all our sponsors and we love their money, but this one kind of hits home. This one's a really good one. So thanks for your money and making a cool product.
Thanks for your money.
Hey. So we're going to grab our dear friend, Dr. Robert Brooks, and bring him on here to do more shenanigans because he's got another book out. This man won't stop. I mean
you're going to have him every time he has another book out. He'll be on like
or something, Bob. You could go like put some zucchini out in the air.
Pictures.
Yeah, I mean, this is a tough read for like 85 minutes. Dr. Brooks, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be here. It's always uplifting. I always laugh when I come on. Hey, you know what? It's I enjoy writing, and I feel passionate about the topics I write about, so that makes it much easier. But thanks for having me on for the 100th time.
Hey, we love it.
Well, thank you.
Love it.
Are you going to say hey every time? No.
Hey. Yes.
So Sam's written other books with you. How do you keep luring him back into this mess? How do you, say to him?
Well, in this book, I'm laughing. He lured me back in, taken from The Godfather, I think, kind of thing. We met 30 years ago. I had been writing about resilience, just a very quick summary for people to know. And then we really hit it off at a conference. And now this is, I think, our 14th book together. But we wrote a book called Raising Resilient Children. And then we realized we should focus a lot on discipline because it was a red hot topic. And we also wrote a book about resilience in adults because many adults, I You know, they said, can you help kids be resilient if you're not feeling very resilient yourself? So we had a book, which actually you years ago publicized so nicely, Chris, The Power of Resilience. And so then we wrote a book about discipline, because in order to really fulfill some of the things we talked about, you had to really think before you acted. Now, when you said lure it in, Sam came to me, it must have been about 18 months ago, and he said, you know, each of us has, he almost called it like a fuel, instincts. And I said, well, what exactly do you mean? He shared with me some of the research he had been doing, that from birth, a lot of the things we had been discussing were there from birth. Like kids as young as 2-3 months already were showing signs of compassion, empathy. They were showing signs at a year old of altruism. This was very encouraging, because that means these behaviors or attributes are there. Now, we called it instincts because they're there from birth. It's not like a bird building a nest, but it was intuitive ways of knowing and thinking about things. So I then, he lured me in. I said, well, let me think about this. And we had a lot of dialogues, and I started looking at some of the research. And I was so encouraged, because I said, altruism, the precursors of altruism are there at a year old, compassion, empathy. So then what it really meant is that we had to think as parents and caregivers, how do we take these instincts, these intuitive ways of knowing and thinking, and they're there, how can we reinforce them? So we called it tenacity, almost like this is the fuel that you need to be more resilient. It was really exciting. You know, I wrote most of it during the pandemic, and so I had more time. And one study led to another. And I more and more said, God, these are some things I had not realized before. And then what I did basically, and we did when we wrote the book, is we said, okay, here are seven that have been identified through research that we know really could lead to success in life. And then came the fun part for me. Okay, what would parents do? And all of my books are filled with dialogue. I love to give dialogue, composites of patients I've seen, real patients, always, you know, always disguised. And that was so much fun. And it was like a culmination of 30 years of our work together, this particular book. And a couple of people who recently interviewed me said, you know, this is a very hopeful book. I always thought all my books were hopeful, but they said, because what you're saying is there's a certain goodness, there's, you know, altruism and fairness within us. Let's understand it and let's see how we can parent to bring it out. So he lured me in this book. First to say that, but it's been a great collaboration. You can imagine writing 14.
I mean, what are you gonna say?
Right. So anyway, by the way, I will tell you quite honestly, at first, when I first saw some of the initial ideas, I really wasn't certain. I said, are we just going to be rewriting Raising Resilient Children again? But this was really very, very different and very exciting. And certainly as a clinician for over 40 years, there are a lot of case examples I've had over the years and working in a psychiatric hospital for 25 years that really I could use in the book to illustrate points about parenting. And even, you know, I was listening to the interview with Heather, obviously. A lot of what she brought up is really in these particular instincts, like empathy and compassion and altruism and listening. So anyway, that question was just a wonderful one in terms of luring people in. But to be lured in, I think you have to be somewhat fascinated or interested, unless it's being forced on you.
Well, right, if there's a gun. So there's seven basic instincts inside of tenacity. I'll read just a couple of them because they can't go in right. This is a very slender tome. So you can.
Yes, one of my shorter ones.
There you go. So in the ones I liked, for instance, were intrinsic motivation. I liked compassion and empathy. I liked simultaneous intelligence. I thought, what an incredible thing to say that these kids at these very young ages even could conceptualize simultaneous intelligence. They don't call it that,
right,
but they're executing on that. So you break these down a little. You talk about things like, you know, the need to belong, which is an important one that I loved. The other thing I had, I have little pieces that I folded over so I could remember to talk to you about them. The need to feel competent. Mm-hmm. I've been thinking about this one a lot. I've been thinking about that one because that and like agency with children, giving mm-hmm. children more agency in their life obviously changes how they perceive and how they operate. So that need to feel competent. Can you give me an example of how we could set that up for a child?
Yeah. It's interesting you selected that one. I'm going to give just a little background. I hope it's okay. I think as a beginning therapist, one of the biggest mistakes I made was out of my own anxiety, when I would meet with parents about their child, they came in to see me because their kid was having problems. I would spend 2 hours talking about the problems. If adults came in to see me about themselves, I spend 2 hours just speaking about the problems. When I went up to the school about a child who was having trouble in school, I'd spend 2 hours speaking about, you know, their problems. And I had this epiphany. Now it's more than 35 years ago. I said, you know, after these meetings, I'm feeling more depressed. I wonder if these people are feeling more depressed. All we're talking about are problems. And I said to myself, it was really a transformative moment for me. What would happen if after just 10, 15 minutes speaking to someone about problems, whether their kids or their own, I interrupted them and I said, now that I've heard about a few of the problems, can you please tell me what you see? And I'll stick with kids right now. Your child's strengths, their beauty. And I had coined the term islands of competence in the mm-hmm. early 80s. Chris, it was just incredible. The whole tenor of the meeting changed. People became much more creative and they became much better problem solvers. Little did I know what I was doing was creating positive emotions. And 30, 35 years later, neuroscientists would define this. When you create positive emotions, even as kids in preschool kids, it's any age, it actually activates parts of the brain that help you with self-discipline, help you with empathy, help you with problem solving. So just to give you a very quick example, the very first time I did this with a kid was a kid who was hitting other kids in school, felt really worthless. And I saw him in therapy and he didn't want to talk to me. And then I said, you know what? Instead of asking about, do you know why you're here? Which was what I was taught to ask kids. I said, what do you like to do? What do you think you do that's pretty good? It was like if the gods of therapy were in my office, they were there that day. Because he said, I love to take care of my pet dog. And I'll just quickly tell you a story. I said, I know very little about taking care of pet dogs. He spent the entire session talking about taking care of dogs. It was so funny. He didn't want to come to see me. When I said, it's time to stop, he said, good session today, doc. Yeah, I called the school principal, and to make a long story short, he was appointed this kid the pet monitor of the school. It was his job to go into different classrooms, and it was a school where they had a lot of pets, make sure the pets were well taken care of. His teacher invited him to write a little book for the school library, how to take care of pets, and his aggressive behavior stopped markedly. And I use that example because he had a courageous principal and a courageous teacher who, instead of, as one parent said to me, punishing a suffering child, found their beauty and strengths. And so islands of competence are important. We all have strengths. I happen to coin the term islands of competence. People really liked it. But you see it. It's there. There was a psychologist, Robert White at Harvard in the 1950s, who said, from birth within every child is the wish to master your environment from birth. He called it a drive for effectiveness. So I'm using the word competent. The same with altruism. There's research to show that if you're with a year or 18-month-old kid and you drop something and you can't pick it up, they will pick it up. But if that child even senses you could pick it up by yourself, they won't. Now, that's not, you know, something you sit down and lecture a kid about. No. It's there. And we have to cultivate it. So I hope that captures a little of the notion of competence, and every one of us has that. And it's very powerful for me.
So Coach Woodard had a question. He asked the question, Dr. Brooks, what's the biggest takeaway that we as parents need for tenacious and resilient kids?
Wonderful question. Actually ties somewhat to what Heather said. In all the research that has been done, the key factor for a kid to be resilient, even if they should grow up under great adversity, which basically is, you know, kids who are resilient, they bounce back, is at least one caring and supportive adult, hopefully many. Harvard put out a big report. They looked at resilience and they said a supportive adult is critical. And if it's not the parents, hopefully it will be the two. What are you two switching? You think I don't notice, don't you?
I mean, who can tell? This has been 5 minutes.
Yeah, okay. I would just say So what I would say is the late Julius Siegel called that adult a charismatic adult. His definition is an adult from whom a child or adolescent gathers support. Why I mentioned Heather, we know, I've talked to leaders that you need that charisma. Even as adults, we need charismatic adults, people from whom we gather strength. And what the other research has shown, when you mentioned compassion, empathy, and I mentioned altruism, in order to be resilient, not only do you need these supportive people, but one of the key components of resilience is when you feel you're making a positive difference in the life of someone else. And that is why when I go into schools, one of the first questions I ask is, even if it's just a seven-year-old, what does this seven-year-old feel he or she is doing that enriches the life of another person or the school environment? And it is critical. And we know from whether they're 3 years old or 93, one of the things that helps people to be resilient is when they feel there's meaning or purpose, that because they're on this earth is a better place, not in a narcissistic way. And that was so exciting because I was doing this intuitively, a lot of these things and some of my research, and then to see the research about infants and toddlers and how it is there to cultivate was very impressive for me.
Elizabeth asks, can you tie this for adults? As long as one supporting adult or peer, can you do a turnaround for a troubled peer in the workplace too, like mentors?
Oh, definitely. I love the word mentor. It's at all ages because the workshops I do around leadership or in the workplace, I will ask this, who do you turn towards? But then I'll say, and who turns towards you? And when Heather mentioned before empathy, some of my favorite questions are, let's say it's a leader, what words do you hope the people you're leading will use to describe you? What do you intentionally say and do on a regular basis so they're likely to describe you in these words? And then if the words you hope they use are different from the words they would actually use, what do you have to do differently? Because when Heather mentioned before self-awareness, which is my book about tenacity in all my books, Daniel Goleman said a basic foundation of emotional intelligence is self-awareness. If the self-awareness is not there, you can't start to make changes if you don't see it in that regard.
I was looking through the rest of the book. I was thinking about other parts I want to talk about. But one of the things I'm really struck with is that how this so seamlessly, we keep saying, this applies to children and it applies to adults. Have you, as a therapist who's worked with both, have you just noticed over and over again that a lot of the problems of adults are pretty much the same problems as kids have that never got handled? I feel like a lot of times in my leadership work, in my coaching work, I feel like I'm in front of a grown-up who's still saying, look what I can do, and showing me their little nine-year-old dance. Do you feel that's the same?
Yes. And it's so fascinating you said that, because after writing a book about children, resilience in children, then writing a book about resilience in adults, the chapter headings are the same. Because what we talk about is, what do you need? What are your skills? What is your outlook? What is your mindset? I talk about a resilient mindset to be a resilient child, how we help kids to be resilient. And it's the same chapters. And someone said to me, who hadn't read the second one yet, the one on adults, said, your chapter headings in the adult book are the same as the child book. I said,
yep.
Because it's the same philosophy. It's the same framework. So yes, we bring in, that's why I talk about, we all bring in scripts to from our childhood. But I also, I'm very hopeful. I say we are the authors of our own lives. That yes. doesn't mean it's easy. And like Heather said, we're not going to be perfect. It doesn't mean it's easy to change. But I like people to think about their life as a script. Where is it going? How would you like it to be different? And then I actually get into, we in some situations, rehearsals with people. Let's think about what we could say. And in regards to that, there's wonderful techniques in positive psychology. We have to make sure we prepare people for mistakes, that we have to really look at. I do this in therapy all the time. Here's your goal. What obstacles do you think you're going to face? But we have to avoid a self-fulfilling prophecy for failure, because then you say, if this obstacle comes up, how do you think you'll handle it? Because the more you feel you have these ways of coping, the more then the obstacles are not going to seem as great. I've always said resilient children or adults see problems as things to be solved rather than overwhelmed by.
That's important. Listen, that's a perfect time to grab back Heather. Heather, our younger, rejoins us. I'm going to put you back where you started.
You get no warning. Just yank you back in.
No, I told her. I said 2 minutes.
Heather, did you see how often they change screens on me? I'm looking at one.
I did. Oh, gosh. And Bob, I mean, I'm just sitting here going, Chris, are you going to invite me back on here to talk to him about this? Because I did a TEDx on transforming adversity into opportunity based on my own childhood experience of overcoming. And I talk about resilience, especially this last year during the pandemic, because people saw the TED Talk. They're immediately like, can you come talk to us about how to do this? And so we talk about reframing. We talk about all the things you're talking about. And there was in my book, the beginning of the book, I talk about this one aunt who did express caring leisure to me in a world where I felt like I was an outcast. I was a black sheep. I was an outsider. And she did these things that made me wrap me back in, make me feel included and like I belonged. And it was kind of got me through, and it was that kind of beacon for me as I had to kind of grapple through lots of things that were going on. And so as you talked about it, I'm like, just shaking my head, like, and he keeps saying Heather, and I'm like, I need to talk to him.
Well, you know, the other interesting thing, Heather, when you say that, in my research I did, some of the most, we call them micro moments now, or micro affirmations, or unfortunately microaggressions. Some of the research I did, it could be just one comment the leader made to someone at a certain time is going to be remembered for 30 years, one gesture. That's what all, the same in schools. I ask people of their memories of school. Sometimes it was just one comment and they remembered, and with the same emotion, they remembered years later. Mm-hmm. And so it's these moments are very powerful. I don't want to embarrass Chris, but the first time I heard him was at one of my son's conferences. And he was so psychologically oriented. I really didn't know his work then, but to remember certain things. And you spoke a lot about the relationship, Chris. You really did throughout. And I was so happy to hear that, because it's so important. I mean, I feel like we're talking to all of the four of us, you know, kindred spirits here.
Absolutely. Yeah. I can think of, you know, what's so funny when you're talking about this idea of resilience and then these stories, I go back to the childhood of just all the adversity and stuff was there. And then I think about when I was in college and I was deciding my major, and there was one professor who to this day, I'll never forget what he said. And this was not positive. This is that caring leadership versus not. I tell him I'm going to law. He says, what are you going to do? You know, after college, I said, I'm going to go to law school. And he goes, well, we're just going to see about that. And I was like, MF. And I know you know what I mean by that.
Yep.
Listen, what's happening in my background is I'm hearing this not good enough stuff that happened all through my childhood, like this not good enough. So when he says it, I'm just like, oh, yeah, I'm going to show you. But I went straight from college to law school, graduating 2.5 years. Like, I was like, I am going to do it. You know, I don't care what you say. But those are all those messages.
No, completely.
But you know what you just, I'm sorry, we're just talking here. The thing with.
Sorry, Chris, I'm just hijacking it.
I think they just invited us to be. But what you said, Heather, is.
I got this all worked out.
I love the people who say, I'm going to show them. The sad thing is the people.
They're like, I'm getting off of this.
The sad thing is the ones who don't have that. So they hear these negative comments, and it's not, I'm going to show them. It's just a confirmation of the negativity, and they go down a certain path. You already said there was a certain, did you say an aunt? You know?
Yeah, there was this one aunt. Yeah, yes. Yeah.
So you see, there's some, I've worked, a number of adults I've seen in therapy, they haven't even had that one, as Siegel said, that charismatic adult, the supportive person. So they hear these comments, and they really feel there's something wrong with me. And instead of then saying, I'll show them, and coping effectively, they quit, they don't try things, they assume a victim mentality. So that probably played a very important role in your life. Your whole face lit up when you started to talk about her.
Oh my gosh,
very
yes.
Very much so. Very much so. I was thinking about Les Brown, who wrote a really swell book called Live Your Dreams. Les Brown was one of the first motivational speakers. He's probably the spark that set me off on the path of being the me that people know. I was a telephone company employee laying on a couch sideways. And you know how PBS.
How are you supposed to lay on a couch exactly?
Whatever. Listen, I'm like watching the TV like
Is
that.
Is there a correct way?
And you know when PBS puts on their best shows and like you watch them because it's like the pledge drive? They brought this Les Brown, Live Your Dreams. And one of the things he was taught is, you know, back in his day, he was from Detroit. Back in his day, they called him educably mentally retarded.
Yeah.
And they gave him that label and he was like, well, guess I'm a screw up. And he started doing that for a good chunk of his school until one day some teacher was smart enough to figure this out and pulled him aside and goes, what are you doing? And he says, look, I'm educably mentally retarded. I'm just doing that. And he goes, you let someone else label you? And that was the first time he realized, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, well, I can pick a label. Story. And so anyway, as you're talking, that I just keep hearing Les Brown too. And don't ever meet your mentors, by the way. So we have another couple things to do. We got to do person of the day and we have to ask the backpack question. And we have to get your butts out of here, even though everyone's in love with you both. So hang on. I mean, it's bedtime early tonight, guys. Hang on.
Oh, and here's our person of the day. Kaboom!
And listen, for quite some time, Chip Griffin was our contender, but Tom Morris stole it away. So I think it was really great that Tom came by. Really appreciative of that. A lot of great feedback and comments today, though. A really excellent community came to show and provide you both love. So I'm excited about that.
Chip says he lays down on the couch face down because someone is pressing him down, trying to keep him from running.
We've seen how that
works. But that can't be true, because why did that not happen also to Chris? That's not true.
I can't. So listen, here's a question. Dr. Brooks has his own backpack at this point, so it's full of all his things. We ask the question every episode, though. What goes in your backpack? Something physical, something metaphorical. Oh, my gosh. Physical or metaphorical, something that maybe will get us through the next couple of years. So it could be something like an avocado, or it could be something like, a hope for the future. Carrie, what's a great physical thing someone could throw in a backpack?
A book you hate, because eventually you'll read it and learn something from it if it's the only book you have with you.
Oh, I like that.
It was Whiskey Nate.
Whiskey Nate said that one. Yep. What's a metaphorical one we could add?
Kindness, I think.
Kindness sounds good.
Ariel Helvetica. That was a good one.
She's the model of that. Let's ask Heather Younger, The Art of Caring Leadership, what she would add to the backpack.
My heart.
Yeah.
Yep. I choose to walk about life with my heart right there. So, and it's the only way I want to show up.
I like it. I'm all for it. Well, Dr. Brooks, your fourth or fifth thing in the backpack, it's getting heavy at this point. What would you like to add?
Just because I've been doing a lot of research, and it's the whole issue of gratitude, two kinds of gratitude. One, to think about what I'm grateful for. And two, which I've really been emphasizing a lot, is to really communicate to others why you're grateful for them, because we know doing that is really Heather said it in one sense in terms of leadership, it's really so tied to resilience. So what we're grateful for helps to sometimes break these negative cycles. It doesn't mean avoiding the problems, and then to acknowledge other people. So like right now, Carrie and Chris, I'll say I'm grateful for being on your show several times.
Well, we will have you back as many times as you want to come back.
Next book, we love talking to you. Boss. Clearly you're not growing any zucchini that need tending.
Tom says, I'm going to go tell my wife I'm person of the day and she won't believe me. And Chip says, it's not that big a deal. I got it last time.
So I was thinking another thing about this ability of like that kid who became the pet monitor full of cicadas. Oh my gosh, it's a crazy year for him this year, I think, right? First in 30. Thank you, Elizabeth. I appreciate that. My grandmother, people don't know this, was a very reasonably successful dungeon master in Dungeons and Dragons. And one of the things that she learned as a good piece of advice is let the monk catch the arrow. So there's all these stats and figures when you roll your character sheet.
Like jump out of the way and let it.
Yeah. So in Dungeons and Dragons, you get all these stats and all these traits. And so the person making these characters up is like, oh, I just put this one in called Catching Arrows. And as a dungeon master, you're always thinking in your head, like, whatever. And they said, let him catch the arrow. So what my grandmother said about this was, here's how you do that. Here's how you like incorporate that into any given.